ich das Recht zu denken. Du willst mir alles schenken, das wird das Schönste für uns sein. Oh, ich will dein Leben lenken und will dich niemals kränken, dann bist du nie mehr ganz allein. Bleib bei mir für alle Zeiten, dann wird dich mein Herz begleiten. Bleib bei mir, oh darling, bleib bei mir, oh
Happy day, faithless listeners, and welcome to episode 190 of the Diddly Dum Podcast, the fourth best Doctor Who podcast out there. I'm Doc.
I'm Mark.
And I'm Sucky.
Hooray!
Hello, Sucky.
Hello, guys.
So, as is becoming almost as routine a part of our intro as happy days, in Hayden's continuing absence, we are joined today by friend of the show, long-time friend of the show, known Sucky for years, but I've never actually spoken to him before, face-to-face, Sucky Kirk, famous from, I've almost lost count of the number of podcasts I've heard Sucky on. I mean, I have seen evidence on Twitter that says that there is no intelligent life on other podcasts, but we'll see how it goes. So the ones I remember are, I mean, currently, Sucky, I'm right thinking you're on the Around the Console podcast, aren't you?
Yes.
The Trek This Out podcast.
Yes.
The Take Your Seats podcast.
Well, that's not a sort of hiatus, but yes.
And weren't you frequently on... Oh, no, I've forgotten it now. What was the Doctor Who podcast that Mark did with the music all through it?
Yeah, it's Proctor Who that was. I was Proctor on the last couple of years of that.
So what has been happening in Doctor Who since last we assembled? I think we've finally seen... Well, there's the obvious thing that happened on the 1st of November. Well, I think we've had the final dates for the three specials, which are going to be The Star Beast on Saturday the 25th of November, Wild Blue Yonder the following Saturday on the 2nd, and The Giggle on the following Saturday from that, the 9th December. And then Shooty's first story is apparently going to be either a Christmas special on Christmas Day or possibly on New Year's Day. I'm not sure which, so we'll have to see how that goes. And we've even heard news, haven't we, that Shooty's second series has already started filming.
Yes, it has, yeah.
Which is interesting. I think that might also possibly cause us some comfort, because I think, hasn't he said, Shooty, at some point, oh yes, I'll be looking to do some theatre work after my second series. And people were thinking, oh God, he's only staying for 2 years. But if they're recording a first and second series in such quick succession after each other, it may just be that you can go off and do a year filming and we won't even notice. What think you, boys?
No, it's the same thing as what I think Tennant did, didn't he?
Yeah, we did Hamlet.
Where he managed to fit in a Shakespeare season in between his commitments to Doctor Who. And I think this is the same thing with Shooty. Shooty's going to be doing the two series back-to-back, sort of.
Yeah.
And then he'll have enough time to do whatever he wants and come back refreshed, which is great. Because you don't want quick seasons of Doctors, you know, Doctor being only there for about 2 or 3 years and then he's moved on to another thing. Because you want him to be happy to come back. And if he's been given the opportunity to do other things in between those seasons, I just think, yeah, let him do it, carry on. Just do it like the way they've decided to do it this time around.
Of course, listeners, that's the local council firework display outside in Biscuit Factory Square. But of course, the biggest news is that we're currently recording today on Saturday the 4th November, and on Wednesday the 1st November, I play as greatest moment arrived when the Hooniverse turned up on there. Is the Hooniverse generally meant to cover everything on there?
Yes.
Yeah. Whenever I watch an episode to review for the podcast, I always put subtitles on because I don't need the dramatic impact of something being said and not expecting it, so to speak. It doesn't bother me. And it's easier just to, for when I'm making notes, I just quickly pause it when somebody's saying something and I can just quickly write down exactly what they've said. It's a lot easier. But I found the subtitles on the story we watched, sometimes they'd be missing like half a sentence out or whole words. And it kind of changed the tone of some of what was said.
This is fantastic. I feel sorry for you for been editing this then, Doc.
I think early on there's a scene where the Time Lord's saying to the Doctor something like, oh, we were doing this before half the universe was born.
Oh, yes.
And for some reason, just as an example, the Time Lords were doing this when half the universe was born. And it's just, it niggled with me so much, I stopped using the subtitles in the end.
Yeah, I agree with Mark there, because I also noticed that when I was watching Genesis, because I'm watching this at work and I've got machinery going on in the background, so I'll put the subtitles on and I'm listening and watching and reading the subtitles at the same time, and sometimes it just didn't match up. And as Mark says, when some of the stuff is missing from that sentence, it just changes the nuance of the scene, right? And so, yeah, that also did niggle me too a bit, but at the same time, also, I'm happy that they've got this sort of thing for us out there, because I just think it's so much, it's a delight for us long-term fans who've never really had an access to Doctor Who on tap, basically. No. Apart from, like, the DVDs, obviously, but then you have to go out to buy them, spend your money, but this is all, like, free, everything online. And I just think it's brilliant for us.
It is great, because it means you can just sit down and without... Sometimes you might think, oh, I might fancy an episode of Doctor Who, and you'll go and you'll look at your shelf and you'll be going, oh, what can I see? And whereas now you can just sort of like go in and just flick on the iPlayer and just say, oh, do you know what? I think I'll watch Mind of Evil or whatever, you know, and it's just right there. And it's lovely to have that. So, yeah, it's not a massive complaint about subtitles. I'm sure that it'll improve the longer they're up. Yeah. I mean, I don't know how long these are likely to stay on iPlayer for. I don't know if this is a permanent thing.
As an RTD said that it's going to be on there forever.
Really?
That's what I've heard. But
okay,
you never know with these sort of things. I mean, Disney Plus and Amazon Prime and Netflix and all them, they've always put shows on thinking it's going to be on there. And then this last year or so, they've been taking shows off because they just don't want to pay the creators any more money. Now, if this is the same sort of thing that the BBC are doing, where they've paid the creators, the writers, and all the other people that need to be paid for the streaming rights for a limited time, I think they should tell us that how long it's actually going to be on there. I mean, most of the time you do see this will be on there for a year, if you notice. But with the new Who that's been on there, that's been on for longer than a year, even though it says will be available for a year.
Yeah. There is one thing that holds true with any streamed media, isn't it? If you love something, own a hard copy. Because you never know what will happen to it.
Totally agree.
Where was all the classic stuff before it went to iPlayer? Where was it being streamed?
BritBox. It was on BritBox. Right. Yeah, BritBox had it for everything, including An Unearthly Child. And I think An Unearthly Child is still on there. You'd have to buy a subscription to BritBox to get it. But that was the only way it was available on streaming in the UK.
Could you get us abroad?
Abroad, I think it was available on BritBox and... I'm not sure how else it was available and what other streaming services was available abroad.
Because I suppose the problem with this now all being on iPlayer is it's fine for us in the UK, but even in Ireland, no one's going to be able to access classic Doctor Who on streaming now, are they?
Now, I've heard this. There's a lot of people complaining, and I've seen it online, about how UK have now got all the episodes, and because they've got all the episodes, it's going to be taken off all the other streaming services around the world. And so why can't we access iPlayer? This project, this whole Hooniverse project, I believe has been financed by the license fee that we pay. Right, so it's an exclusive iPlayer content for this country only. whether the BBC then license all the classic Who to another streaming service. I don't think it's going to be Disney Plus. I don't think Disney Plus are starting from the specials, and they're not going to put New Who onto then either. But if the BBC decide to license this to another streaming service, then it might still be available around the world. And if BritBox is an international streaming service, it must still be on there.
And presumably, if it's all going to be on the iPlayer, whoever, any streaming service is going to probably pay them less, aren't they? But then I suppose it's if BBC's happy to put it on iPlayer, they're only probably putting it on another streaming service just to make it available rather than because it's going to be a huge money spinner. But it would really piss me off if I was in Australia. And not being in Australia itself would piss me off. But it'd be annoying with that.
What's worse is it's the new content like Tales of the TARDIS and stuff that they're not going to have access to, isn't it?
But talking of Tales of the TARDIS, that seems the newest content we've had. I've seen all six though, right, you, Sookie?
Yes, I've seen all six. Fantastic. I really enjoyed it. I did put out a tweet that I was a snotty mess after watching all six in one go because it just brought down all the feels. And I loved the interactions between the Doctor's companions and whoever else was there. I mean, Clyde and Katie Manning were together. Daniel Anthony, I think his name is. They were together for that episode. And the fact that they're coming together at the end and you can wish people that have passed away into existence, right, for another thing on the...
That was nice, yeah.
So you could have dead characters who have died on the show come back and still be played by the same actor, I assume?
I have to say, I've only watched the Fifth Doctor and Tegan one, and I watched Jamie and Zoe. And obviously, as listeners will know, the death of Adric had a profound effect on me as a young chap. So one thing that I was really worried when I went into it was that they somehow, I know this will sound counterintuitive to what people might think, I guess, but I was really hoping that they hadn't somehow managed to, oh, this time we'll go back and save Adric and he'll be safe, because I've spent all my life getting used to the fact that Adric died and his death was such a huge impact on me. And, you know, it's informed a lot of my, I don't know, it's just become a part of my fabric in a way. And I think to have that undone would have felt slightly cheap and weird. And I'm really glad that what they did was actually just a really nice memorial to the character of Adric, actually. What did they say? That silly, stupid boy and stuff. And it just, when they were talking about him, it just made me think of myself as a kid as well. And I felt, don't know, it felt like I was kind of giving my past a bit of a hug. And it was quite lovely.
He was so...
Oh, he was a nightmare.
He was daft and silly and sulky and... He was just a kid.
He loved you.
Yes. I realise that now.
I thought it was a bit more convincing that when we reviewed Castro Valva the other week, and Tegan for a while was saying, oh, but we've got to go back to save Adric. And I thought, I'm not convinced, love. This one's any more convincing. But in the first Doctor one, where you've got Stephen and Vicky, I don't spoil this for you, Mark, but yeah, I will anyway. At the end, they say, oh, like Sookie was just saying, if we remember hard enough, would the first Doctor turn up here? And then you see just the light of the TARDIS door opening, and they're looking at it, and a shadow appears just on the wall behind them. Obviously, you don't see it. It's not like, what's-his-name's there, David Bradley or anything. And I was thinking, are they going to do this for the Peter Davison one? The door will open, and a shadow will move unconvincingly across the wall behind them.
Oh, come on now. I thought you were going to say it was, and it was Morton Dill, because Peter Purvis couldn't keep his mind on the job. Oh, no, I'm sorry, I started thinking of the wrong thing. A bit like when somebody mentions the Stay Puft Man, and they can't stop thinking about it, and that's what appears.
I like some of the character background that they've put in for these characters. Because Russell T. Davies has says that these are canon.
Mm.
So you're going to have bits that have been... I mean, I can't spoil it for Mark, but they go around putting stuff in which develops his characters and it gives them backstory as to what they've done since they left the Doctor, or the TARDIS, I should say. And so you get all this stuff. And in Jamie and Zoe's case, there's a big major development there.
Yeah, oh yes, I saw that one, so.
Yeah, so now they can... I don't know how many people have not watched this. How spoiled do you want to get?
This isn't going out for another 1.5 weeks, so if by then they haven't watched it, f*** them. What happens with the Jamie Zoe thing? I can't remember that. Other than the fact that they remember each other from now on.
That's it.
Ah, right, yeah.
That's what I mean. Because now they remember all their past adventures with the Doctor, whereas, you know, in the War Games, they had their memory wiped off half on the first adventure that they had with the second Doctor. Now, they remember everything. So they've got all these memories returned to them. And what they were saying is, once we leave the TARDIS, this remembrance TARDIS, they've got a feeling that they will carry on remembering everything that they lost previously. So I think that's fantastic. Because I've always hated the fact that they wiped their memories. It's a bit like Donna having her memory wiped.
Mm.
I hated the fact that Jamie and Zoe had their memories wiped of all the adventures, all the good times and the bad times, but all the good times that they had with the Doctor. And I think that was just utterly, utterly wrong. Now, having their memories back, they can remember everything.
I quite enjoyed Donna having a memory wipe because it meant that she could never reappear.
But that didn't happen, though.
Well, the RTD's put a stop to that, hasn't he?
I hate to sound like I'm some sort of masochist, but...
you but, are!
I hope that when I go back to watch the War Games that I still get that horrendous kind of despair at the end, because it's one of the it's one of the emotional beats of it. That's that moment where they say goodbye, it always tears me up, and I don't want anything to take away from that emotional impact, really. But I'm sure it'll be fine, because I mean supposedly they still have spent the following decades, however long it's been, not able to remember, which is still pretty sad. But
it is sad, but there's always been that inkling, as I mentioned in the episode itself, there's always been that inkling that there was something that they were missing, and that's why you had kids named after each other. So they have got some sort of residual memory that is still there.
When was this film? Do we know?
September.
Oh, September, okay. It's interesting because we interviewed Wendy back in April, and obviously this probably wasn't on the cards then, but she picked as her favourite story to do, the best script that she'd had, was The Mind Robber.
Russell did say, I think he mentioned it on one of his Instagrams, that he decided he had an idea and that he decided he'd put that into effect, and this is what he put into these six stories. I mean, I think he's written one, maybe two, and then you got Phil Ford and Pete McToy who did the others. So this is all done quite quickly, within a month of Russell deciding he wanted to do it. And it's only a small set. Just ask a couple of the Doctor's actors come back and you just film it in half a day, maybe, for each one.
Yeah, it's lovely. I thought I might be a little bit more cynical about it, actually. Wasn't having a great afternoon and I sat down to watch it. And I thought, I'm not sure my head's in the right place for this. But no, it was lovely. Yeah, it is sentimental, but it's really nicely done. And you know, RTD is a dab hand at
bringing out the feels.
Yes.
As the kids say.
Exactly.
I preferred the Fifth Doctor one, best of all, because I thought, although I'm not he's particularly keen on his Doctor, I thought his performance was the warmest and the most effortless. It actually shows he is a... Who was it was saying he was a brilliant actor? Was it possibly someone else, really, anyway? And then after that, I found Sylve and Sophie the most enjoyable. I did think, when I first put them on, oh, these are all going to be about 90 minutes long.
Yeah.
I didn't realise that the vast majority of it was an omnibus edition of Earthshock in the middle.
No, speaking of omnibus editions, there was another announcement, wasn't there, yesterday, as we're recording, which was the announcement that there's a recolorised...
Of course!
...and re-edited, cut-down version of the First Daleks serial, being broadcast on BBC4 on the 23rd of November, on the anniversary itself.
The rumour I've heard is they've taken the original 7 episodes, they've cut it down so that Ian and Barbara start going through the tunnels through the mountain and then immediately come out again, and it's cut it down to about two episodes in the end now. Well, that should actually be really good, that, shouldn't it? It should be. They keep hinting, don't they, that, oh, there's more to come. I wonder if... I don't know if I was a little sad that there wasn't a fourth Doctor, Tales of the TARDIS. I wonder if Tom is now perhaps a bit frail. I'm not saying too frail to do a performance, but perhaps too frail for you to still be able to think of him as himself in the good old days.
But I like the way that they brought back the Doctors in Tales of the TARDIS, you know, as they are today.
They're not trying to disguise it. Yeah,
no, they haven't disguised it. Now, they could have brought Tom back as well. But as he says, some of the latest photos you see of him, he looks frail. And he doesn't look like... He probably only wants to do audio recordings because it's easier, does it from home, and he's quite happy doing Big Finish. Having to physically come out to a set and to do something there might be a bit too much for him. So he's decided not to do. But then on the top of that, who's he going to appear with? Because this lady's passed away. Mary Tam's passed away. Louise was, from what I heard, was she got commitments on Emmerdale, so she couldn't have been released. The only other one would have been John Leeson as Canine.
Of course, yes.
If they decide to do something, yeah, I'd love to see Tom back on a Tales from the TARDIS. And no matter how frail he looks, I'm sure he'd be great in whatever he's asked to perform.
Tom might be saying, not that bloody dog again. I can't get to do a two-shot of that at my age.
I have to say, I agree with everything you said about Tom there, because I got the DVD documentary out that goes with Genesis of the Daleks, and I was watching Genesis of the Classic, and that features quite a lot of lovely interview clips with Tom. And I remember at the time when I first saw that, I remember thinking, oh, isn't it sad how Tom looks so old, and he's put on so much weight, he looks a bit sort of chubby and stuff. Yeah. Isn't it a bit sad? Whereas now, that was like 20 years ago nearly. And whereas now I look at it and I think, oh, isn't it lovely to see Tom looking so young and so well?
Is that the one where he pretends to take a call from his first wife?
Well, you say pretends. Who knows? But yeah, it's brilliant. It's a really good documentary, actually.
It's a long one, isn't it?
Produced and directed by someone whose name I didn't recognise, Ian Levine.
Levine. I wonder if he's related to John.
I probably haven't seen that documentary since I first got the DVDs, like nearly two decades ago. So,
from what I've heard, Tales from the TARDIS is supposed to connect with stuff that's being shot later on.
Okay.
Oh!
So, if I'm remembering correctly, there's some sequence in some of the new series that's coming up in which something happens, and that sort of triggered what Russell decided to do with these six stories. And he decided to write this, but this will then sort of connect with something that happens in either Shooty series, I think, or might be the special, but more like the Shooties.
Well, it might be part of the explanation as to why David Tennant's back as the Doctor, I suppose.
Oh, because he's a memory or something.
It might even have something to do with the reappearance of the Toymaker. Who knows? Who knows? Can I just say, regarding the new recolorised, edited version of...
Mark, it's not recolorised. It was never colorised in the first place.
Sorry, yes. No, quite right. Yeah.
I tried to tell you. I thought I'd butt in, but you said it a second time round. I thought, I've got to butt in this time round.
Yeah, Doc, we don't need him on again.
Sorry, mate.
No, that's fine. Quite right, too. It's had an odd response online.
Has it?
A lot of people are very much in my group, which is that I'm interested to see what they've done. And as long as the original version's still available, which it is, then it doesn't really make any difference to me. But I have seen some people being upset that it's been done in the first place. And I've also seen some people using it as a stick to beat the original series with, which I think is a bit out of order.
But you could look at it like that, because it's been edited down from 100 and whatever minutes it was for the seven episodes to a 75-minute story, that there was a lot of padding in there. I don't understand people's dislike for this sort of thing. It's just an added extra. You've still got the original there if you want to watch all seven episodes whenever you want. But you've also got this little bit, which is 75-minute story version of this actual story. It's like the omnibus editions that they used to do in the 70s,
yeah,
where they just cut them down. You still got the originals, you just got another version of it. I just don't get why they've got a dislike for it. The people that's behind it, I just think they've done an incredible piece of work for the fans. And these people are fans, because I know one of them, Kieran Hyman, he's a good lad. These people are fans, and they only do it for the love of the programme.
Mm-hmm. I just want to say as well, I spoke to Polly earlier on this week, and I told her Doctor Who was now on iPlayer, and she hasn't watched, I don't think she's watched any for ages while she's been at university, and she's been far, far too busy, really. But she was genuinely excited about the prospect of suddenly having all that Doctor Who just there on the iPlayer for whenever she felt like it. And she said she's going to get her uni housemates to sit down and watch The Demons with her.
Oh, right.
Nice, nice.
So I'll let you know how that goes.
The other thing I'd also notice with the iPlayer, some of the animations are on there. And because on the DVDs and the Blu-rays when they were released, most of it was done in black and white and colour. There's some animations on there which are in black and white, and there's some animations which have been put on in colour for the 60s stuff that was animated. So I just don't know what the selection criteria was. Was it why have they decided to put a black and white one instead of a colour one, or why they put a colour one instead of the black and white one?
I was going to say, I wonder if it depends on the animation studio on what they were given the rights to put on. Also, I wonder if the reason why they haven't got the most up-to-the-date recent prints of some of these, you know, I think I saw screenshots from The Invasion, which looked particularly, like, incredibly dark and quite blurry. But I wonder if that's to do with trying to keep things back for the collection boxes and future sales.
Possibly, yeah. Right then, faithful sisters, those of you who are fluent in German, and those of you who have a good ear for music, will doubtless have discerned from our opening fanfare that this week we are going to be talking about Genesis of the Daleks. Oof. That was timed well, wasn't it?
That was. I thought, wow.
I thought that was a special effect.
Yeah, it sounded like the Mastermind music was about to start. Boom, dun, 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 dun.
I told you it was a bad idea, Mark, to record this podcast in the wasteland during the war.
Don't mention the war.
Fourth Doctor story from his first season, season 12. Originally broadcast in March and April 1975. Written by Terry Nation et al. Directed by David Maloney. Music by Dudley Simpson. Mark, would you care to start us off? If you can manage to hold back the tears for what you were saying yesterday.
Well, this probably is one of the stories that I've watched most of all, I should think, out of all of Doctor Who. I must have watched it, I don't know, possibly up to 10 times, which is the most I'll have watched any episode over the years. Since initial broadcast. I think one of the reasons for that as well is that when I've had friends around, quite often, if they're not necessarily Doctor Who fans, but they grew up with Doctor Who, if you say to them, oh, would you like to watch a Doctor Who story? They'll say yes. And then you'll say, oh, what Doctor shall I pick? And invariably they'll choose a fourth Doctor. Mm. And then also they'll invariably pick the Daleks. Now, as much as I love Destiny of the Daleks, it's not the one I'd tend to choose to put on. It's always been Genesis of the Daleks, because it is I'm aware that some of the idiosyncrasies of my taste don't always translate very well to other people. So I've seen it a lot. So I did worry when I sat down with it that this was going to be overly familiar. And then as I was watching episode one as well, my heart sank a bit further as this certain real-world events going on at the moment that this rather brutally brings to mind. And I was thinking, this isn't really how I want to spend my next sort of best part of the 2.5 hours. So I was having these kind of second thoughts, thinking, oh, I don't think I'm going to enjoy Genesis this time around. And perhaps, you know, I've heard naysayers in the past. It's dropped down the charts, hasn't it, in recent years? You know, it was, as the DVD case proudly displays on its front cover, the number one Doctor Who story of all time.
Oh, really?
Back in 2000 and whenever it was the DVD came out. And I was starting to think that I was falling into the camp of people who actually didn't rate this story as highly as they used to. And then we got into episode two, and God, I thought this is really dragging. The whole episode just seemed to fart about a lot. And then it's just, didn't seem to really go anywhere much. There's a really clumsy exposition dump, which I wasn't expecting when Tom's been suddenly thrown back into the cell with Harry, and he just explains everything. Oh, well, I was talking to them, and it turns out this, and this. And it's like, oh, that's uncharacteristically graceless, I thought, of Robert Holmes's writing. And so I switched it off and I went away, and I thought, oh, what a shame. Genesis just isn't, it ain't what it used to be. Oh, also, sorry, I'd just like to point out as well that as terrifying and frightening as that climb up the rocket is at the end of episode two, and as horrifying as that cliffhanger is where they do that freeze frame on Sarah Jane dropping down, knowing the denouement of that just absolutely spoils it. It is such a cheap resolution. It's the cheapest resolution I've seen since they turned the Doctor into a stone weeping angel. And then next episode they went, oh, we only did it just to transport you from A to B. Yeah. Here you are, you're all right now. And I gave that quite a kicking. And I thought, well, I can't in all good faith go on the podcast and not mention that at the end of episode two here. So that was disappointing. So I went away with, I don't know, my spirits were a bit low, really. But then, I don't know what happened. Episode three came on, and everything just started clicking back into place again. And all that disappointment just dissolved. It just faded away.
Oh, thank God for that. Knowing the new you, Mark, this won't mean anything to you, Suki, until you hear episode 189. Knowing the new you, Mark, was there lots of lovely violence in it?
There was, yeah.
Oh, great, this is better.
Well, I mean, the intro from episode one is fantastic. Landing in the middle of a war, all the mist, the Time Lord, the mortars going off, the people in the gas mask, the corpses. And it's just, it's really evocative. Like I say, it's hard to enjoy some of the war trimmings with what else is going on in the world. Mm. But I say, I got to episode three and I absolutely sailed through the rest of it. And I think a lot of that, as a whole, the production's just fantastic. On everything.
Hmm.
I mean, David Maloney, who directed a lot of Blake 7 and stuff as well, didn't he? And he did Tanzer Weng Chiang, and what else did he do?
David Maloney is someone who Thomas and Liz and all the commentaries always say, oh, he's wonderful, isn't he? So he's clearly probably what they call an actor's director.
Yeah.
Someone who knows how to get the best out of actors.
Yes. Hold on. So I've just got these bloody fireworks.
Not directing a bombardment onto the
Hoosium Dome.
Yeah. Doesn't matter. Only a matter of months ago, Hayden came up with a new substance which has the strength of 30-foot thick spreadable gem. So we're okay. So, David Maloney.
So, David Maloney's production is absolutely superb. Everything looks really good. Everything's lit perfectly. There's scenes where Davros is just in the shadows and you just see his blue eye coming on, and he glides out of the shadows, and it just looks so good. And the way the Daleks are shot, and they're all gleaming and shining, and they shoot them from various angles. It never looks flat, like some of the Dalek stories. I'm looking at Richard Martin here, I think, in particular, you know, the older Dalek directors, things that look terribly flat on screen. But you don't get any of that here. It's very dynamic.
Mm.
And I think one of the main things that absolutely drives this whole story... I keep throwing my arms around. I'm forgetting you can't see me. One of the main things that absolutely drives this whole story is Michael Wish's Davros.
Mm.
I'm never, ever bored when he's on screen. It's just, as a creation, he's... brilliantly realised, from the mask to the costume to the whole chair setup, he's brilliantly written for, because he has some divine dialogue. I mean, it's obviously his whole line about the that would put me up above the gods, you know, is great. But he also gets stuff like when he's talking to the scientists and he says, It was you who introduced the word democracy.
I will abide by the decision of the majority.
You already know the decision of the majority. You will lose, Davros.
With such confidence, you can hardly deny my request. It was you who introduced the word democracy.
And that bit as well, when he said, he's saying that basically, I mended your heart.
Yes, yeah.
It's just brilliant.
Kravos, I saved your life once. In your chest is a tiny instrument which I designed. It keeps your heart beating. Will you now turn that heart against me?
And the way that Michael Wish's performance is just so complete, from the shaking of the hand. There's so many close-ups of the hand and the way those fingers sort of come out and they caress the switches on his control desk in front of him on the chair. And then the way that when Davros is talking and he's getting angry, just see his whole body just starting to tremble with rage. It's just a superb performance.
It is.
In a very real way, Michael Wisher is my real Davros, and all the other actors who've come after him really have been my step Davroses.
I've often think it's strange that when he reaches his hand across on the front of his chair to pull a switch, most of the main switches seem to be right on the far side, so he has to stretch over really far. Like, you know, there's sometimes the idea of like a QWERTY keyboard is supposed to be that the most commonly used keys are in the nearest place. I wonder if that's why he grows his fingernails so long, because he can just about reach and then just use the end of his nail to pull this switch down.
Just to flick it.
Yeah. The scenes that you're going on about where they just linger on him, you know, about to press a button, this is one of the things that I think really puts me off this story. Now, when I used to initially watch this, and I never really got into this story, and I couldn't put my finger on it, but when you start doing a review on it and you put down your notes and you decide, you realise there is a lot of padding. A lot of padding in this story. There's bits where the Doctor and Harry escape and they're captured and brought back to the same place. There's a bit where Sarah escapes with Severin. They're captured and brought back to the same place.
Yes.
It's just backwards and forwards. A lot of capture, brought back to the same place.
There's that whole bit as well when Davros has said, okay, yeah, fine, we'll have a vote. And they're like, should we do it now? No, let's just take our time with it. Let's go really slowly. And let's have some long speeches during it.
Yeah. So this is why I've never really rated this story. Now, coming back to watch this,
there better be a but at some point.
Yeah, I've not heard your opinion on this yet, Doc. So you're going to have to bear with me. Now, coming back to this story, there is still all that padding and there is still all that stuff that just did my head in initially. But there's a but for you. There you go, Doc. The fact that it has some really great performances in here does make it a classic, because if you don't have a performer like Michael Wisher putting his heart and soul into the way he portrays Davros, it just would not work. Because the way he says things, the way he does things, I mean, actually doesn't do much then, because he's sitting rigid in that chair and the only thing that moves is his mouth and his hand, and that's it. But the way he conveys everything through his voice makes his story. And then you got the speech with the capsule, as Mark says. That speech really elevates his story, because you've got this megalomaniac, this absolutely genius person, but who has no scruples and no morality, morals, where he will go around killing everything just for a science experiment. And so that character elevates his...
Davros, if you had created a virus in your laboratory, something contagious and infectious that killed on contact, a virus that would destroy all other forms of life, would you allow its use?
It is an interesting conjecture.
Would you do it?
The only living thing, a microscopic organism, reigning supreme. A fascinating idea.
But would you do it?
Yes. Yes. To hold in my hand a capsule that contains such power, to know that life and death on such a scale was my choice. To know that the tiny pressure on my thumb, enough to break the glass, would end everything. Yes. I would do it. That power would set me up above the gods. And through the Daleks, I shall have that power.
Now, on top of that, you've also got Tom Baker performing his heart out in this story. Because yeah. he just brings a lot of stuff to this story where you just think any other doctor within this story would not work. The way him and Harry work together.
Oh.
The way he interacts with Davros. The way he bullies people in some of the sequences. I think this is his best performance in his tenure. I do honestly do think this story, I do think it is a classic. And there's a number of, as I say, there's a number of things. It's the character performances. The story is just bump. There's a lot of padding. There is a lot of padding. I know it's the beginning of the Daleks, but the Daleks only appear for a small amount of time in the whole story. But at the end when he says, we're going to put them back for 1,000 years. How is he going to put back 1,000 years? The Daleks got all the technology and all the resources within that bunker to be able to get in and out of that bunker. Right, they are that powerful. They ain't going to put them back 1,000 years. I just think there's a lot of plot holes, but I still do think it's a great story.
Yeah, I agree. Can I just say as well, your comments with regards to Tom's performance, he's extraordinary in this. I mean, he's got that swagger, hasn't he, that the Fourth Doctor has, just the way he breezes through, even under capture and threat of torture and, you know, all the no tea, Harry. I mean, I think the highlight of it for me is probably in... at the start of episode 4, when he thinks that Harry and Sarah were in the Khalid Dome when it was bombed. And the look on his face, the resignation and the look of defeat on his face.
Absolutely.
It's really powerful. Because the Fourth Doctor is so swaggeringly confident, to see him have the wind taken out of his sails like that, it's a real gut punch. And then when Betten says to him, are people now considered Davros to be a hero? And he's just his resigned sort of shrug and sigh. And it's really powerful stuff, I think.
The bit there, though, it's the following scene when he does find them again.
Mm.
He's happy to see him, shakes Harry's hand,
yes.
and then gives a quick grab, press of the chest together, and then pushes Sarah away. Because they don't do this sort of thing, as Peter Davis and Janet Fielding said in Tales of the Time. They don't hug. We've never done this sort of thing. The other one, which I think, for me, was a great Tom and Ian Marta scene, was where Ian Marta, Harry, saves the Doctor from the mine, and the Doctor slowly picks his foot off the mine, turns around, and gives him a big, massive grin and goes, thank you, Harry. And
yeah.
I thought, that's my Doctor there. That's my Doctor. I love that. The fact that he has called, or will call, Harry an imbecile. In future episodes, but here he acknowledges how great Harry was, and that toothy grin just makes it all the worthwhile. Just seeing, oh, thank you, Harry, with a massive smile.
His relationship with Harry in this is wonderful.
It's lovely, isn't it?
Ian Marta's great as well, and even those bits like quite early on, but the Doctor's saying that we must get the time ring, Harry, it's vital. And Harry says, yes, I know it's vital, but we don't want them to know that. And it's like, you know, he's not an idiot, Harry, in this, as he's occasionally made out to be later on. And it really makes you miss Ian Marta and the character of Harry. And you think of how hard done by, really, they were. We discussed this quite a lot in our Ian Marta retrospective back in the day, didn't we?
Yes. Podcast 66.
And just how Philip Hinchcliffe now sort of looks back on it and regrets that he got rid of Harry so soon, and he feels that he should have done better by Ian Marta with regards to, you know, Ian Marta's last scenes as Harry are in the Android Invasion, and it's not a great way for the character to bow out at all, is it? And I think Philip Hinchcliffe regretted that in retrospect. And it does make me sad that Harry's not there for longer.
Mm.
You know, him and Tom together, and him with Liz Sladen as well. Also really good. He's just a lovely, warm, charismatic actor, I think brought a lot to the series.
See, I think it's all down to the writers here. The writers should have been able to pair the Doctor and Harry up a lot more, whereas I think during that season 12, they just kept Harry to the sort of side, and there was a lot of stuff that was just Liz Sladen and Tom Baker, because that's been the dynamic for the past 12 years. It's been a Doctor and a female companion.
Yeah.
Because remember, initially, Harry was supposed to be a character that was supposed to be there for an older Doctor, not a Doctor of Tom's age who can do most of his own stunts and most of the action bits himself. So with Harry being sidelined, his character sort of became redundant. But then that should have been down to the script editor and the producer to say, look, you've got to bump up his role, because we're not paying an actor just to be standing in the background. We need him to become more of the narrative. But I think he's used more in this story and a bit more in the early bits of Ark in Space.
Yes.
And then after that, the other stories, he's not really a main character. He's just somebody who just hangs around with the Doctor and Sarah.
No, I totally agree.
I want to know what Doc's opinion is, because he's kept very quiet.
It's a wonderful character, Harry. This, in Genesis, is the real Harry we know and love. Not, who are the bloody fools who reimagined him working at Porton Down?
Yes.
On a gas which would turn Zygons inside out, and had the Doctor dismissing it as the imbecile gas. I mean, there are people who claim to have loved Doctor Who all their lives, and yet are capable of writing crap like that, which call into question the understanding they have of the show. And wasn't that the same episode where Kate Lethbridge banality tells us that the Brigadier died disappointed that the Doctor had never saluted him? So unlike their relationship.
Yeah.
Who writes this sometimes? Even in Harry Sullivan's War, which Ian Marta wrote himself, he was working on antitoxins there and was only moved into weapons research against his own strong objections. Okay, rant over, my thoughts on Genesis. Well, what you say about who's doing the writing, I think is so important. I don't think we'll ever know to what extent the script writing was Terry Nation's work, to what extent Bob Holmes, as script editor, made adjustments. I think the general accepted story is, isn't it, that Terry Nation was asked to write a Dalek story for season 12 before Philip Hinchcliffe and Bob Holmes came along. So Terence and Barry received it. They said, oh, it's very good, Terry, but you've sold us this same story at least twice before. So it's either Barry or Terence suggested to him, why don't you go in and give us a story that looks at the Daleks' origins? You've not done that before. Now, I think what makes this story so different to a standard Terry Nation potboiler, I think, has to be the Daleks themselves being largely relegated to the background and being replaced by something you don't tend to get in Terry Nation potboilers, which is a spectacular individual character in Davros. And I do wonder how much of, as I think Suki was saying, the plot is very much, you know, much of a muchness, you know, it's just a standard Doctor Who plot. There's nothing particularly stands out. But what stands out are the characters, and that doesn't seem to be something that you remember from Terry Nation's past stories, doesn't it? See, it's a fun romp with the Daleks usually. And so I do wonder how much of Davros comes from Bob Holmes.
I think there's a temptation, isn't there, with looking at this story and trying to work out who wrote what, to think that all the sort of padding and the toing and froing is Terry Nation, and all the rather splendid dialogue, it must be Robert Holmes, which perhaps is unfair on Mr. Nation, but
I'm sure that's unkind of him, but that's never stopped me before. And I was trying to think back, are there any other previous Dalek stories before this where you get some of the character death and the richness of dialogue that you get in Genesis? The only one I could think of was Day of the Daleks, which maybe reinforces this point, because, of course, that was written by Louis Marx, wasn't it?
From what I've read, Terry Nation did write most of it, and Robert Holmes sort of finessed it. But there is a version that is based purely on Terry Nation's script, which Big Finish only released, I think, this year. I haven't listened to it myself, but they've done the version, and then where it sort of deviates from the broadcast story, they've done a dramatisation. The bits that have exactly the same. It's, I think, Nicholas Briggs just narrates that those bits.
Is that the bit where Davros and Nida are in the cellar, laying the trap for Garman, and Davros says, "What's that?" And Nida says, "There's something in the ventilation shaft." That's a very big finish line, isn't it? Oh, yes, it's Dalek's Genesis of Terror, which I think claimed to be a full-cast version of Terry Nation's first draft of Episode 1 of Genesis. And there's nothing on there to suggest that the plot varies in any way significantly between this apparent first draft and what eventually goes out on broadcast. And there's also We and Other Daleks, which Terry Nation wrote as a story for the 10th anniversary edition of Radio Times in 1973, where a character asks the question, "Do we have the right to wipe out the Daleks? Wouldn't that make us as bad as them?" It was the first time I'd considered the deeper and long-term significance of our mission. With unlimited exdelium, we could totally annihilate the Daleks. And I had no doubt we would. But did we have that right? If we destroyed them, what made us better than them? Did the very existence of the Daleks in the universe have some greater meaning? It was certainly only the menace of the Daleks that had welded the new worlds into a single unit. The peoples of all planets had stopped warring against one another to unite and battle against a common enemy. Now that sounds very much like...
Yes.
Certainly that Have I the Right morality theme in Genesis. I think Terry Nation wrote something called A Doctor Who and the Daleks book, where he sort of retcons a lot of it to try, and it talks about things like, you know, how it was that Davros became crippled and so, but quite a lot of it seems to be dedicated to explaining why these cities are so close together. That's not actually the original Thal and Daleks and Khaled cities and blah, 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 blah. It does come across a bit chibnally. With the Morbius faces. I mean, there's nice little things like explaining away the why they're called Carlites, the sort of Dals. This is quite good.
Can I just say as well, I know that obviously there's inconsistencies, isn't there, from this story compared to what we know from the first Dalek story. Things are different. And I always put that down to, this is time travel. So there's absolutely no reason why things aren't, I hate to use this word because of the baggage now attached to it, but everything's in a state of a flux the whole time because people are travelling backwards and forwards through time, including the Daleks themselves. So things are getting tweaked. People are popping up here and there. So timelines and events. I'm doing things with my hands again.
I'd rather not know, Mark.
So timelines and events can get warped and shaped, reshaped and changed.
Yeah.
And I think that's just part of it. And I think that's why UNIT exists in that strange kind of, we're not sure where it happened because there's been so much time travel in and out of that period.
Yes, that's what you mean, yeah.
For those people, that it just kind of almost warps time itself. Anyway, that's my headcanon.
I really can't be bothered with the stuff like the distance between the two cities. I can do away with that.
I can't.
Because everything that matters is so captivating. And I wonder, let's ask... This is going to sound terribly rude. But what year are you born in, Suki?
70.
Right, so you're about... I was born in 66. And Mark's about...
I'm 71, so...
When I was 10, I got the famous Genesis of the Daleks soundtrack LP for Christmas. And it's one of those things where I taped it onto an audio cassette, front and back... And so many nights, I mean, obviously, these were the days when if Doctor Who wasn't on original broadcast on TV, there was no way of getting hold of it, apart from your Target box. And I would go to bed at night, and I'd have this, my tape recorded down the side of my bed, and I'd listen over and over, God knows how many times I did it, to this. And of course, because they've abridged it slightly, it becomes less obvious that... They just stroll down the end of the lane and, oh, and there's the Thal City. Oh, actually, it seems more credible and they've just cut out the bit where they're clearly they're spending ages travelling there. But I also think, I mean, what you were saying earlier about, I think it was you, Circuit about, I think there's a lot of padding here. But I also think, because it's a six-part story, there's also a great deal of dialogue. I mean, I actually think with this that there's not that much action and not that much running down corridors. Because the wonderful thing for me with this character of Davros is that although, yes, he can rant along with the best of them, he isn't really a standard ranting Doctor Who villain, is he? Of course, he loses it at times. And when he starts ranting is when he sounds closest to being sounding like a Dalek, isn't he? Well, the greatest thing for me about Davros is that he is a credible individual as a character. Mm. Admittedly, a barking loony. But you can see why. Even at the final debate in the laboratory, where he's doing the thing about, I saved your life with a pacemaker or something, some of the elite do actually cross the floor to his side while he's making his argument. He doesn't seem necessarily to be from fear. He has a sort of diabolical charisma, which makes it actually easily understandable why people might follow him, particularly in the middle of a war. I always remember the first time he enters the lab, I think in episode 2, when he's, you know, they plug the Dalek's gun into its empty socket for the first time. He doesn't start with calling everyone to attention by saying, "Silence, scum! Filthy underlings!" You know, like the pirate captain might do in the Pirate Planet. He's just a very quiet, soft, "If I may have your attention."
"If I may have your attention. For some time, I have been experimenting with the Mark III project. Details and modifications will be distributed later, however. I am anxious that you should see immediately the remarkable results that I have achieved."
But it comes across like that, as he says, but it's because he's got Noida as the person who
does the
intimidating.
The iron fist in the velvet glove.
That's it. So he's got him standing behind him. So the scientists are probably more afraid of Noida than they might be of Davros.
Yes, possibly.
And with Davros, they have got all these achievements that they've done together.
I mean, that's the point that I'm making, that he goes to the trouble, Davros, of including them in it. I'm anxious you should see the remarkable results we've achieved. I am anxious. It's not something that a supervillain in Doctor Who says. It's a, "You will agree, I think, that voice control represents remarkable. You will agree, I think." You know, it's another bizarre one.
It's very passive.
Sutek or Wang Chiang will probably say, "You will agree or I'll have you shot." And in the final debate in the laboratory, he's talking about, you know, "Would you destroy everything that we've achieved? You know, that we've achieved." And the famous line about, I've saved your life once by keeping your heart beating. Will you now turn that against me?" And I think the importance is not just it shows his ability to manipulate people's feelings. It shows him as someone who actually, not necessarily when you're watching it on screen, but clearly off camera or, you know, a few years before we see this story happening, actually interacts with the people around him. They might well know that if they try and rise against him, they might be ruthless against them. But they have personal histories together, which I think it makes it more credible. I mean, how many Doctor Who stories would you get someone coming to the supervillain and say, "Oh, so-and-so's heart is failing"? The villain would just say, "Oh, let him die, we must weed out the weaklings." On the firing range at the end of episode 1, where we first see Davros and the Dalek, he calls Garman "my friend." And I'm not suggesting that he's actually a nice, cuddly guy, but he's got, you know, sort of personal interactions with people. And you can understand why they're not necessarily thinking, "Oh, this is a psychopath, we must rise against him." But there we are. I'm not sure if any of that makes sense.
Well, all I was going to say was that he needs these scientists. He needs them to help him forward the Carlid race into Daleks. He might have perfected it, or he's in the process of perfecting the transformation, but he still needs these. That's what when he's trying to get as many onto his side as possible to help him carry on his work. Because if you're the head of a department or a research facility or whatever, whatever discoveries are discovered under your leadership, you're the one that's remembered for it. And this is why he still needs these people. He doesn't want them killed. And when the Daleks turn on him, he's just as horrified because he needed them. Now, there's a big Finnish story where it's Terry Molloy as Davros. And again, I know this ain't canon, but it's one of these things that you could also think about some of the backstory behind Davros, as Big Finish thought about it, is that there's a character that he sort of falls in love with, and he thinks they're going to have a life together. But when she starts to eclipse his work, he's ruthless, yeah. And he does something to her just to get rid of her. And so this is a guy that will take all your credit for the work that you guys have done, and he'll use it for his own abilities or his own needs.
Who wrote that story? Ray Kuzik?
I think the other thing with Davros that's interesting about him is how much they sort of seem to reflect even now, current world, in modern day concerns and stuff. But the way that a charismatic leader can sort of rise to power but isn't necessarily, and the way that they can use populism to kind of, you know, the hatred of the Thals to further their own rise to power. And I think that's interesting. And also, recently there's been a lot of talk in the media about AI. There's obviously always been fears of science and what good is science going to do? And I think that's very relevant with regards to AI at the moment. Watching this, and you see the scientists go, Davros has created this thing, but it's got no morals, it's got no conscience. And we're having those discussions now, aren't we, about AI?
Mm.
Who's in charge of it? Who's programming it? Who's giving it its personality, its moral compass, or what? You know. And so I think that's interesting. I mean, as well as obviously it's look at war. So I just think that's very relevant as well today. And it's those themes. I mean, yes, there's a lot of padding in the plot and a lot of backwards and forwards, but I think it's those themes which were clearly relevant when it was being written and I think are still powerfully relevant today.
Mm. I mean, you can see what an extraordinary character Davros is, because if Davros wasn't there, had never been invented, we'd all be saying, well, we probably wouldn't actually give him... We'd probably all be saying, wouldn't we? Oh, what an amazing character Nida was, wasn't he?
Oh, yeah.
But he's almost, as brilliant as he is, he's almost in the background. And he fits into what I was saying earlier about the soundtrack LP being from the generation which lived off the Genesis LP as a boy. There's so much in this story where the mere sound rhythm and intonation of lines is burned onto my memory. And the Doctor being reunited with Sarah and Harry is a huge one.
Harry!
Hello.
Sarah!
Oh,
I can hardly believe it!
You rarely get unalloyed delight from the Fourth Doctor. So much of my memory of this is verbal. I don't remember people running down corridors. I don't remember Daleks coming into rooms. I remember what's said and how it's said. And so the fact that Davros comes in the room and he's speaking quietly, and the other guy who does that is Nida.
Mm.
Peter Miles, I love his way with words. I've always liked him, Doctor, well, anything, but particularly Tom is someone who often does this, when actors have clearly given some thought as to how they're going to deliver lines. And so you get sentences up, maybe to make a point, maybe just because it's going to be different than how you'd expect people to do it, where the natural rhythm of the words is changed.
Peter Miles is Nida. It's, again, another great character for this story. The way he portrays it, as you've been saying, he's just quiet, stands in the background, and the way he delivers his lines, his short, sharp bursts, and you feel the menace in his voice. And that's how you must have felt when you were listening to the LP, basically. If you listen from the soundtrack, it's a short, sharp burst, and the menace he puts in his voice, because, as you've said, he's there in the background most of the time, just standing there watching. There's that scene where Garman and, is it Cravel, are talking, and he's standing towards the side of the room and just watching them. And he does it a couple of times in the story where he just stands and listens. And then he comes up to Garman, and I think that's the first and only time you can see like emotion on his face, because he's trying to look scared and he's trying to ingratiate himself into Garman's way of thinking, basically. I'm on your side. I don't believe in Davros or the way he's doing things. We need to find out like-minded people. And he's doing that. But then suddenly, that's what I needed to know. And he just suddenly changes again. And I think Peter Miles is another one of these, as Nida is another one of these great character actors for this story. That elevates it to a classic.
Yeah. And also the first scene of when the Garman goes down to the basement, he's looking for Nida. Nida's just stood back against this wall. And he's got a big grin plastered over his face, hasn't he?
Hmm.
So it's perhaps the only two points at which he displays emotion, but he's faking it both times, isn't he? But what I was saying about disrupting the natural rhythm of sentences, where he says things like,
"Your views are not important."
Or, "Open the safe for us."
"Only Davros knows the combination."
Well, you wouldn't say that. You say, "Only Davros knows the combination." What's the other one that he does, which I think is really good, where they're being interrogated when they first arrive in the bunker, and they just, "Oh, we're from another world." And I just said,
"I've heard Davros say there is no intelligent life on other planets."
No, he's speaking as if Davros is already the topic of the conversation. Not, "I've heard Davros say," which would be the cue for someone to say, "Oh, who's Davros?" "I've heard Davros say," as if, you know, everyone knows who he is. And probably emphasises his centrality to all their lives. But then little things like the way he ends some of his words.
"They're not Thals and they're not mutants.
We'll find out what's different about them. By autopsy."
By autopsy. And a line which is rooted in my memory from the LP.
"Bring the prisoners."
"Bring the prisoners." I do love it. And as you say, the crowning line of all, which I think was once the central purpose for a whole Twitter account, wasn't it, Mark?
Yes.
"Thank you. That's what I wanted to know."
"That information will prove most helpful."
And I think this superb use of dialogue and of the delivery of dialogue is possibly what made the soundtrack LP so compelling. Because I think certainly for my generation, a lot of the popularity of Genesis was generated by that soundtrack LP. Don't know how many they sold.
I know I've got a copy in the other room, so I bought mine secondhand.
Can I also just, when you're saying about the enunciation of certain words as well, just a big shout out for Michael Wish's delivery of fascinating.
"Fascinating."
Which, as you say, could have just been, you know, in the script, it's just Davros says fascinating, but he does this fascinating. It's just lovely.
"Fascinating."
There's something that about a delivery of a line. It's basically a little cry. It's when Dennis Chinnery's Garman gets knocked out. He goes, "Ip!" And I think, what? There's something else. Did you notice all the way through this story the signs, the big massive signs that they put, like "total destruct button" was one. There was "safe toxic" was another. "Safe toxic level" was another.
Yeah.
There was a "fire destruct panel" button. And I was thinking it's one of these things that sort of took me out of the story, but at the same time it also puts it as a highlight for the stories at the same time.
The total destruct button's always a classic.
Classic. There's the clam. Clam. Oh, good grief. Ian Marty's acting in that is fantastic. Top notch. He's acting against an inert clam. And then when they account for them again, where there's a half a dozen, and they suddenly jump through, clams that are not moving and not attacking or not doing anything. And it's like, oh, these three actors are really putting their heart and soul into this of trying to escape from something that's just lying there on the floor.
Family of clams. A clamily. It's funny as well because you see, before they go into the caves, you get this quite impressive one that passes the ventilator shaft screen just before they go out into the cave. There's this knobbly, slimy-looking thing lurches past, and then it's... you never see it again.
With the Ice Warrior backing. If you can now, it's an Ice Warrior...
crocodile effect. Yeah.
Harry must be super strong against... I don't know if it's because it's a different planet and his gravitational forces, whatever, but... When they're rescuing Sarah at the bottom of the shaft, at the bottom of the rocket, he just walks up to the guy and just punches him once in the gut. And the guy's knocked out. No, straight on the ground. I just say, I think Harry must be super, super strong.
Oh, he's got form for that, though, hasn't he? Doesn't he do that in Robot as well? He's quite a...
A boxer in his past life.
Yeah. Well, Ian Martyr's got the physique for it, hasn't he? He's got that square jaw.
The actress that played Betten, do you recognise her?
From Blake 7, I recognised her.
From Blake 7. She's more famous for the wife of Secret Lemonade Drinker.
Yeah.
Oh, is she?
Yes. Do you know that? Our wife, Secret Lemonade Drinker.
I'm a secret lemonade drinker.
Always. Always.
I'm trying to give it up, but it's one of those nights.
Always.
Always. Always lemonade. I'm a secret lemonade drinker.
Always, always,
always lemonade.
Always, 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 always,
always lemonade.
The singing on that TV ad was, of course, done by Ross McManus, Elvis Costello's dad.
Oh, really?
Our last podcast, we did Tim Burrows, which hasn't gone out yet, we're reviewing Ambassadors of Death. And we point out at one stage, was it John Abernary Mark who was the butler in the original Ferrero Rocher Ambassador's advert?
Of course. What's the name of that actress? Sorry.
Harriet Philpin.
Of course, Harriet Philpin is better known to me and Doc from our Sweeney Watch, where she was in one of the greatest episodes of all. Oh, shit, is it called Taste of Death?
Which one's that one?
It's the one where there's like a kind of weird flat shopping centre. It's one of the Douglas Camfield ones.
Oh, well, the police sniper is wondering whether to take a shot. Yeah,
yeah. And she's in the bank, isn't she?
She gets taken
away as a hostage in the car. And it's a beautifully shot episode. Like I say, it's directed by Douglas Camfield, so it's not surprising. It's a great episode.
One other thing that I just wanted to mention. Noida's Kosh. Now, you've seen him as a proper wooden... Kosh, like, and then when he whacks Tom over his shoulder and knocks him out, it's slightly bent.
It's got all flaccid.
Yeah, it turns into something slightly more
like a black pudding than a
cock. Erotic.
Hey, I tell you what, this is full of. I mean, this is slightly sacrilege now for Mark and me, but if you accept Allo Allo as being part of the Secret Army canon, this story is full of Secret Army people. The guard who knocks Sarah off the top of the rocket and then catches her is...
General von Klinkhoffen.
Is General von Klinkhoffen and Hauptmann Müller, Reinhardt's secretary.
Oh, is he the one who says, sorry, love?
Yeah.
I can't imagine people on Scar I saying, but there we are.
Hilary Minster.
Guy Siner is, what was he called? Lieutenant Gruber. And Severin... is Stephen Yardy, Max the Pianist. Oh, excuse me. Oh dear, that's going off again.
Yeah, I think that's a Carly Dome destroyed.
Yeah. Morality is one of the big things in this, isn't it? The whole...
Yeah.
Going back to the Have I the Right. Can anyone tell me what was notable about the drummer at the Honeycombs?
No idea.
She's a woman.
Oh, right.
You know, one of these things where, you know, you've got all the band are wearing very close-fitting 60s suits and their guitars are almost right up underneath their armpits. Mm-hmm. Then they're doing that. And she's, what's she called? Honey Lantry, I think she was called.
Just touch these two strands together and the Daleks are finished. Have I that right?
To destroy the Daleks, you can't doubt it.
But I do. You see, some things could be better with the Daleks. Many future worlds will become allies just because of their fear of the Daleks.
It isn't like that.
But the final responsibility is mine. of mine alone. Listen, if someone who knew the future pointed out a child to you and told you that that child would grow up totally evil, to be a ruthless dictator who would destroy millions of lives, could you then kill that child?
We're talking about the Daleks, the most evil creatures ever invented. You must destroy them. You must complete your mission for the Time Lords.
Do I have the right? Simply touch one wire against the other, and it's it. The Daleks cease to exist. Hundreds of millions of people, thousands of generations can live without fear, in peace, and never even know the word Dalek.
Then why wait? If it was a disease or some sort of bacteria you were destroying, you wouldn't hesitate.
But if I kill, wipe out a whole intelligent life form, then I become like them. I'd be no better than the Daleks.
Think of all the suffering there'll be if you don't do it.
The whole have I the right thing. Was that 8 or 9 when this went out? And the whole thing about, someone pointed out to your child and said that one day he'd grow up to be a ruthless dictator. Could you kill that child? And on the other side of the argument, which is, no, actually, that these darts are going to kill billions of people, you've got to destroy them. I remember even at 8 or 9 years old, I could tell the difference. I could understand the morality of it. I could understand even abstract concepts like, you know, to hold in my hand a capsule that contains such power. I could see there that actually Davros was insane. He would destroy everyone just for the kick of being able to destroy everyone. You know, not for any particular purpose about it. And I think it's only when you're an adult that you identify examples of it in things like history and literature and the podcasting and the world around you in your own life. And in a way, this goes right through possibly to the 50th anniversary, doesn't it, Day of the Doctor, where the Doctor initially refuses to join the wires and blow up the Daleks.
And also the Ninth Doctor's coward every time.
Yeah. At the end of the Time War, just before Series 1, he changes his mind, doesn't it? And he presses the button that kills everyone. And at the end of Series 1, he's with his great line,
"What are you, coward or killer?"
Coward. Any day.
And he refuses to press the button. All right, that's slightly screwed up by him going back to do it later on in Genesis and the Dalek doing it for him. And it turning out, actually, despite the fact that it's blown up, it turns out it wouldn't wipe them out forever after all. But I think the point that's being made here is not, is it morally right for him to blow up the Daleks, or is it morally right to not blow them up? The point is that he bothers to pause to question it.
That he looks for a better way.
Yeah.
That's not me.
And it's not entirely inconsistent, because when Davros is saying, right, give me all this information, I'm going to torture Sarah and Harry, he chooses to save them rather than the universe. Perhaps in the hope that, you know, the tape might still get destroyed. But you don't get that much sort of moral complexity in Doctor Who dialogue normally, do you?
Right. Now, I could also retcon this in events that the Doctor tells Davros are all fixed points in time which will not change.
Oh, that's interesting.
So all these events that Doctor's describing are events that cannot be changed. Now, the Daleks themselves, I think it's been mentioned, the Daleks themselves won't touch fixed points in time because they know they can't do nothing about it. So if the Doctor goes around describing all these sort of events,
oh, that's interesting,
then the Daleks can't change them.
I'm not so sure about that, because there's real jeopardy about them getting the tape back and destroying it, so...
Yeah, but at the same time, the Doctor could just be thinking, I've given them all these events, but at the same time, I might as well just try and get the tape back anyway, right? Because why give them that sort of foreknowledge anyway? Because they might develop something else, maybe.
Yeah.
But did you also notice the continuity error in that, the stuff that he was telling Davros? He says in the year 2000, the Daleks invaded Earth.
Oh, yes, yeah. I noticed that, yeah. But like I say, this, that goes back to my thing of which I guess is just kind of a bit like David Tennant's Doctor's timey-wimey stuff. But, you know, time is in flux and things change and things move.
You're very right about the lighting. Do you remember a guy called Duncan Brown, I think?
Yes.
And I think you first see it in the firing range at the end of episode one where we first see the Dalek, and Davros sees they're all in shadows, aren't they? And even the corridors in the bunker they're running down. The Thal city, for some reason, seems to be very brightly lit, all the corridors. But in the bunker, they're just little bits of corridors are lit, aren't they? So as people run down the corridor, as Daleks glide down the corridor, they pass through these bits of light, whereas you're not seeing a glaring normal studio lighting on them.
People are always saying one of the weaknesses of the Daleks is that they can't climb upstairs. I'd say surely their first problem is how the Daleks going to get past the piles of corpses that they've just littered the corridors with.
When Davros is saying at the end, they removed the traitor's body, so I'm not quite sure who he's talking to. But the three humans are left alive. Talking of things like the soundtrack LP, did either of you get hold of, in the 70s, the Doctor and the Daleks omnibus book?
Yes.
It's
the large hardback published by artists, published from Marks and Spencer.
I was going to say Marks and Spencer.
I forgot that.
Yes.
And that included the novelisations of Genesis of the Daleks and Planets of the Daleks, and with some fabulous art in them.
Oh, it's glorious.
Yeah. It's lovely,
is it the same guy who did a lot of the annual artwork as well?
Possibly. There was an article in, I think the most recent, if there's such a concept as the most recent Warp, about 37 years ago, I think it was published, where it's focused a lot on comic art. And I think they interviewed at one point the guy who did the art on it for this. I can't remember what it was, but it was...
Yeah, I remember.
It's the sort of thing that now, if I pass that in Marks and Spencer's today, I think, oh, just another bit of, you know...
Tat.
A tat. But I must have... I can't remember actually seeing it. I must have rushed off and grabbed my mum and dragged her over to try and guilt her into buying it for me or something while we're in Marks and Spencer's. And that sort of thing... It used to be our life, didn't it?
Yeah.
Our Doctor Who life. I've spoken before about how my most vivid memories of Doctor Who when I was a boy was not actually watching it on the TV. It was all the stuff you did between the seasons on the TV to get your fix. Like it was the Terence Dix's Doctor Who Monster book. It was the Target novelisations. It was the Pescatons. Things like that. I'm not sure if I'd even bother to buy packets of Weetabix nowadays if I saw there was. But I was, I used to sometimes have three Weetabix for our breakfast for going to school to try to hurry up the family's need to buy a new packet of Weetabix.
See, my history with Who isn't with the TV show itself initially, it's with the books. It's seeing the books in the libraries.
Yeah.
And the bookshops. And I used to read them, borrow them from the library, read them. And it's only about 1980, 81, when I'm about 10, 11 years old, that's when I started watching the TV show religiously and just carried on from there. And as Doc says, as you're growing up, your obsession starts slowly and fixates on one thing. And for me, it was the books first, and then it goes on to the TV show.
Michael Busher apparently modelled Davros's tones on the tones of Bertrand Russell, which I thought, no, he didn't.
Did he?
And so I found him on YouTube, actually. This is how I dislike him.
Now, what are we going to talk about?
Well, Lord Russell, as you approach your 80th birthday, I think we'd like you to tell us what you think you have learned and what you think you will never learn in your career as a philosopher.
Well... there are some things that I don't think I shall ever learn, and that indeed I hope I shall never learn. I don't wish to learn to change my hopes for the world. I'm prepared to change my beliefs about the state of the world, about what happens, but not about what I hope. About that, I hope to remain constant.
And it's comparable to a story about T.S. Eliot getting a taxi, and I read this in the Times. It was a letter from Valerie Eliot that wrote it, about him getting into a cab and the driver pushing back the glass panel and saying, T.S. Eliot, isn't it? He said, yes, I didn't know you would recognize. Oh, I know them all. I've had them all in my cab. Oh, yes, I've had them all. I know them all, he said. Do you think I had any here last week? Bertie Russell in my cab. Greatest philosopher in the Western world, right? And he said, oh, yes, right. He said, oh, right. And you know, I said to him, Bert, what's it all about? And you know, the twit couldn't tell me.
Does anyone have a favourite Davros who is other than Michael Wisher?
A favourite step Davros?
Yeah.
So you got the choice between David Goodison and Teddy Molloy. That's yeah. What do you say? What's the new Who one?
Julian
Bleach. Oh, he's not bad. But I think the mask was such a... And the fact that Terry Molloy, who is almost... he's almost up to his armpits sitting in that chair. I think Michael Wisher said in an interview, I'm not sure what happened about Destiny. I was working in Australia and America a lot then, touring in theatres, and the first I knew of Davros' reappearance was someone asking me why I didn't do it. I've not seen it, but I have seen a photograph, and I think the mask failed, it just didn't fit. Then I was contacted by JNT, who said he was doing a Dalek story with Davros, and wanted me to play it. Of course I said yes, made sure I had no other work, and prepared for it. The scripts came, the dates were arranged, and then there was a strike at the BBC and it was shelved. I went on to more work, but then JNT rang every so often and kept saying it was going to happen. Then it was on again. I had to make a decision, and although it meant less money and shorter working, I said yes to Doctor Who. And there was another strike, and I was out of work. Eventually, a resurrection did happen, but I couldn't wait and take the risk of no work, and so Terry Molloy ployed it. Very well, I thought, but that mask was awful. He looked like a frustrated Ina Sharples.
It's funny, isn't it, that mask gets its own credit in the...
It doesn't.
...closing credits.
Really? Oh, what did it just say? By John Friedlander.
Yeah,
brilliant.
There's a bit in the Genesis where the mask, you can just see it's fallen off his face slightly. So when you're watching him in most of the scenes where the chin is, and the mask has been glued on properly in this one scene. Oh, I can't remember what it is.
And it almost looks like he's got a white lipstick on.
Well, not just that.
Like a clown.
It's loose. It's just flapping there. So his chin, the mask has not been glued to his face properly. So there's a gap between the mouth, the mask, and the skin. And it just looks weird. Because it's a close-up on there. He's actually got a close-up on his face. And you could just tell that somebody hasn't noticed that the fact the mask has slipped.
I did think that, you know, Davros's line, just before Ronson dashes in to save the Doctor at the very beginning, he says that, brilliant, it has detected the non-conformity. That could easily have been a line by Mary Whitehouse, couldn't it, about one of her followers?
This was one of the stories that Mary Whitehouse went after, weren't she?
Yeah, I know.
And I don't understand this, not too much in here, that would get her ire up. I mean, there's a bit where one of the mutos is holding a knife, and that's about it. There's no blood. There's a couple of times where somebody gets whacked on the back of the head with a kosh or a...
Black pudding.
In black pudding.
Yeah.
There's no blood when the machine guns go off. So I just don't understand why this sort of set her off.
No, I mean, for me, the most horrifying thing is that freeze frame on Sarah falling, really.
Mm.
But I mean, it is quite a violent story.
That freeze frame, did you know who did the stunt there?
It was not Terry Walsh, is it?
Terry Walsh appeared in the story. Now, it's a 16-year-old called Tracy Edden who went on to do Princess Leia stunts for Star Wars.
Yeah.
And she also went and did Icy's stunt in a couple of Sylvester McCoy stories.
Oh!
I don't think they'd have done that now. Health and safety. Can't have a 16-year-old do the stunts.
No.
So in the sort of mid-ish 90s DWM poll, this came first by... 2009, I think, in the Mighty 200 poll, it dropped down to 3, having been replaced by, admittedly, Blink, that's reasonable, and Caves. And then in our own retrospective of the poll of the Tom era, it came, oh dear, fifth. Oh, honestly, some of our listeners. Genesis fifth, Talons fourth, Pyramids third, Robots of Death second, City of Death first.
One thing I spotted this time around, I'm sure this has probably been pointed out by other people. In fact, I've probably listened to podcasts or seen videos where people have discussed it, but it's completely gone out of my mind. So it was a bit surprise to me. This is the wonders of short-term memory. So many things are new to me. Like I'm like a newborn baby. When he's emptying his pockets and he's got that little card pops out of his pocket that's membership to the Alpha Centaurian Table Tennis Club.
Yeah, from robots.
That appears on the table here. This little green card also that he empties out, same time he empties out his sonic screwdriver. And I just thought, what a lovely, funny little joke that is. That just imagining Alpha Centauri and playing table tennis with the bat in each hand against the Fourth Doctor. And it's just a lovely image.
Right. Anything else to say? Right. But we lost Peter Miles, of course, a few years ago. And I think, once again, I'm going to revive. I think I've only done this once before. The bowdlerisation of Auden that I did to commemorate his death, which I call Funeral Blacks. Stop all interrogations. Cut off the bunker's phone. Prevent giant clams from biting Harry's ankle bone. Silence the protesters, and with muffled drum, bring out the coffin. Let the mourners come. Let trans-solar disks circle overhead, scribbling the message, Nida is dead. Put iron crosses around the necks of the public doves. Let secret policemen wear black leather gloves. The cells are not wanted now. Send the prisoners back. Pack up the truncheons, dismantle the rack. Put away the jodhpurs, sweep up the wasteland, for they'll never again be so great a henchman. So, let's give it a marks out of 10.
Give me a number out of 10. 10 being woohoo, 1 being...
I'm going to give it a 10.
Oh.
Mark, have you recovered, Mark?
Yeah. What? Well, for Ian Marta, for Michael Wisher, and for Peter Miles, I would like to give it a 10. But my head has to rule over my heart. I would turn that heart against this story, and I shall give it a 9.
Sucky, are you going to play the role of the nonconformity?
I can't give this a 10. I don't. I've got to be honest to myself. There's a lot of stuff going on, and there's great performances, and it's a cracking story, but there's a lot of padding. There's a lot of inconsistencies. There's a lot of plot points that are just wrong.
And there's a family of clams.
And there's a family of inert clams that are suddenly somehow deadly. So I can't give it a 10. I really can't. Sorry, guys. So it's going to have to be an 8.
Oh, that's not bad.
8.5.
So, Suki, thanks for joining us. It's been a blast. Have you got anything interesting coming on regarding your podcast around the console? Check this out. Take Your Seats.
Take Your Seats is a movie podcast where we'll discuss a favourite sci-fi film of your choice, and you just come on and we will positively review it. Now, with Take Your Seats, it's sort of been dropped to the background because we've been playing D&D on Wednesday nights. So that's sort of
marvellous.
Fallen to the wayside for a little bit.
Oh, I'm jealous.
But then we've also got my other podcast, which is Around the Console, which is with Bob, Craig from old Proctoroo, and then Cliff and John, who joined for this podcast. And that's a Doctor Who review podcast. And we are currently just doing a classic or a new Who show, and then a big finish as a bonus episode. And that's been released every fortnight or so. And then we check this out. We do weekly reviews of Star Trek shows, whether there's a Star Trek show on, a live-action Star Trek show on being broadcast at the time. So we'll do a weekly podcast on that. Saying that, we have got an episode that I'm recording tomorrow, which by the time you guys put this episode out, would have also gone out. And because the ladies on Trek This Out also are Doctor Who fans and they got an opportunity to talk about Doctor Who, we will also be reviewing the specials coming up in a few weeks' time.
Okie dokie, splendid. Well, as ever, faithless sisters, we shall put links to all of these in the show notes on our blog at diddlydumpodcast.wordpress.com. Right, so in that case, oh, who's this coming down the corridor to say goodbye to us? Surely it's not. Why, it's Security Commander Nida with a tray of seafood around his neck.
Cockles and mussels alive, alive, oh. Cockles and mussels alive, alive, oh.
Security Commander Nida, could we have a look at your wares, please?
Certainly.
You've got cockles and mussels. Oh, you've got some giant clams here. Oh, lovely. They're, hang on, I think they're still alive. They seem very active.
They're very fresh.
Oh! Just got my fingers! I think we'd better discard them. Can you think how we might get rid of them?
Don't dump failed genetic experiments into the river.
Security Commander Nida, Security Commander Nida. Look out of the window who's crossing Biscuit Factory Square towards the Corporation bonfire. It's Dusty Springfield.
Thank you, that's what I wanted to know.
Oh, well, there he goes. Right, well, I think that we ought to join the festivities outside, don't you, boys? Let's go cob a coal in. Bye-bye, everyone.
Goodbye.
Bye.
Been listening to the Diddly Dum Podcast. Find us on our blog at diddlydumpodcast.wordpress.com, on iTunes, Spotify, Stitcher, Facebook, and Mastodon at Diddly Dum, on Twitter at diddly_dum, or email us at diddlydumpodcast@yahoo.co.uk.
Diddly Dum, the empty space that circles time.